This is Matt Wells at UN News. Well, if you're an avid follower of COVID-19 developments, you may have wondered what the phrase PCR equipment means. Well, it stands for polymerase chain reaction, which is the process that labs use to check whether someone with COVID-19 symptoms has the new coronavirus after taking a medical swab, usually from both nostrils. In line with World Health Organization advice to countries to test as many cases of suspected infection as possible, the race is on to find enough PCR machines for everybody. And that's where Paul Molinaro comes in. He's the cool, calm and collected head of logistics at the WHO, which, with other UN partners, is part of a major new initiative to help kit out 135 countries trying to see off the pandemic. He's been talking to UN News' Daniel Johnson.
So right now it's trying to get us access to products that are in extremely short supply because of very high demand, and be able to get access to those markets collectively on behalf of lower income, middle income countries, acquire, finance, buy and move those things to a platform from which we can deliver via aircraft managed by WFP and others to the countries where those things are needed.
How many countries are we talking about?
So it depends on the type of, on what product. I think on last count, we're anywhere between 120 and 135.
We all know that there's massive demand and not enough supply for face masks, gloves, but what's the other equipment that you're really trying to get hold of in massive numbers?
Diagnostic tests, different types of high throughput, automated or manual PCR systems is critical. And then in biomedical, it's mainly around provision of oxygen. So oxygen concentrators, oxygen manufacturing machines, ventilators, CPAP machines, oxygen giving sets, and the sort of masks that go with it. So it's the PPE, it's around the protection for the health workers, lab workers. It's the diagnostics to be able to identify and test who is infected. And then for those unfortunate enough to hit the clinical front line, it's the equipment needed to treat them.
And where exactly is it going to go first? How do you prioritize need?
Well, it's difficult. So we have developed a model based on epidemiology, based on a number of inputs that we make for each country on the attack rate that they're currently facing, how many cases they have. And then from that, we get an estimation of how many bed spaces they would need if they were moving to a clinical environment. And that also putting in terms of what are the percentages of mild, severe, severe, critical cases that we're experiencing averaged out. So it is a little bit of a guesstimate and had to be done with modeling. At the same time, we have a matrix WHO has issued and updates regularly on the various risks and vulnerabilities of countries. Of course, we also compare that to current case count and the rate of spread in each country to try and get a sense of where we should be going first and with what numbers.
And let's just talk about demand for a second. You were saying in an earlier press conference that demand is 100 to 2 times above normal, you know, totally unprecedented stuff. So is this a significant enough measure, bringing together enough UN agencies and non-UN partners to make a real difference?
Well, it's what we can do. So certainly we start off with bringing our UN partners into the shop and coordinating and working with them in terms of trying to bring together the volumes and the financing that we can collectively get hold of, and then approach markets, which we have. I mean, different entities have different experience in different markets. So we try and use what we're strong collectively at. And that, I think, just gives us a more coordinated approach. Again, beginning off on those elements we work closely with, so our sister UN agencies, and then some of our larger NGO partners from which we have a long-term standing relationship, and organizations like the Global Fund and financing institutions like the World Bank, like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, to be able to front-load or bridge financing for us to acquire some of these quantities.
But with the best will in the world, when borders start closing and countries start hanging on to the food and equipment that they need to withstand this COVID-19 new coronavirus pandemic, how do you overcome those barriers? And the concern I have is that the World Food Programme said that there's delays at the borders. You yourself mentioned that UNICEF may see some difficulties in distributing vital vaccines. So what's the prognosis? What's the outlook?
It's difficult and it is a big challenge. Now, what we do is we do have a long track record of being able to circumvent some of these bottlenecks. We're humanitarian and disaster logistics professionals. It's not new to us. It's something we do as our bread and butter, and we'll continue to do so. Now, with the infrastructure and assets we put in place managed by WFP, that's another partner that we've worked with a lot in the past to reach areas that are difficult to reach. And then around the difficulties with export, I mean, WHO has country representation across the world. So does UNICEF. So does the UNDP. So within the entire UN system, there are ways that we can advocate within certain governments. And if you see, some of these export restrictions do include generally provisions for exemption for humanitarian and medical movement. It's not always easy to navigate the exemption, and it takes persistence, and you do have to jump through hoops. But again, persistence is something we do. We're used to it. And so we push forward that way. Now, where we get availability, we'll address any export issues. We don't face it in all countries. We do get specific exemptions that are negotiated, and we do see movements. It could be more, and certainly we will continue pushing for that. But again, with access to a scheduled sort of cargo facility provided by WFP, and with the know-how that collectively we have as UN agencies and NGOs, we can circumvent this.
And I guess very last question to you. There's reports that air travel is going to cost 50% more now. Presumably that'll have the same sort of knock-on impact on your work. So how will you manage to keep the show going, if you like?
Well, I think when it comes to putting back the passenger networks online, obviously they're not going to be able to fill their planes with people. So certainly even when we're planning for the WFP passenger service, you know, they're not going to be able to have a complete full plane. I mean, especially not at the beginning, they're going to need to be distanced. So any airline company is going to have to factor that in. Now, will that same price go onto the freight element of that goes underneath the plane? Maybe it will be cheaper. You're not actually loading so many 20 or 30 kilo sets of luggage into the hold. Maybe frees up some capacity for cargo. On some of these things, one never knows. Certainly when we were trying to find air freight from China when Chinese manufacturing was down, it was very cheap. When Chinese manufacturing came back online, it becomes more expensive. It's just the nature of supply and demand, overcapacity and undercapacity. So, you know, as these airlines come online, maybe air freight will get cheaper on certain routes, certain segments. Maybe it's going to get more expensive. So sometimes these things can be a bit hard to predict. Certainly, we were living in a topsy-turvy world at the beginning when a lot of countries were sending support to China, and air freight into China was expensive. Now it's the other way around, and the price coming back has gone up.